This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, you. Yeah, you, in the cafe. Did you know that over half of the people who listen to Joy are allies of the LGBTIQ+ community, just like you? So you may not be aware, but times are very tough financially at Joy, and we're reaching out for your support. Tell your next door neighbour, your friends, and even your dad to head over to joy.org.au and help us build Joy Nation by making a donation. Joy, your voice, your radio station.
This is Saturday Magazine.
And you are listening to Saturday Magazine from Victoria's Pride Centre, Australia's only Pride Centre, in fact.
Second largest in the world.
Second largest in the world.
But on one location.
Any more adjectives, Macca? Keep on going.
It's actually on one location, it is the largest in the world, because the one in San Francisco is on two locations.
Is that right?
Yes. So we are the biggest. Size does matter.
Who's on the line? I'm not sure about that, because I've seen the one in Toronto, and I thought that was
much bigger. Oh, okay, you want to argue with me now? Okay.
Maybe.
I'm the president.
Anyway, we are going to be speaking with Misha Ketchell. Misha Ketchell is the editor of The Conversation. Good morning to you, Misha.
Good morning.
Great to have you back on the airwaves again.
Where are you? Bedroom, kitchen, garden? Where are you?
No, I'm actually in the spare room now. I've been shifted again.
We have a little bit of echoing in the background, but I think we can deal with that.
That's all right.
Misha, we've got a series of topics. We could talk about all sorts of things, but I think I'd like to talk about something that's non-COVID related to begin with. I know we'll get there eventually. Talk to us about climate change. There's been some key developments in News Corp's thinking, and they have decided now to actually run a campaign pro-climate change. Tell us about that.
Yes, so there's a memo that's gone out after a meeting of the News Corporation editorial board. And basically what News Corporation is going to do is launch a campaign for zero emissions by 2050 after really a period of about 30 years of the most shameless, irresponsible climate science denialism you could imagine. So much so that James Murdoch actually left the company to some extent over his concerns about it. And Tim Flannery, actually the Australian scientist, said that basically what News Corp have done is really destroyed faith in science and really held back action on climate change. So it's sort of being seen by many people as quite a belated move, but potentially a welcome one in the lead up to the Glasgow Climate Summit.
So they have an editorial board. I thought it was just a Murdoch making a call.
Well, if you speak to Murdoch editors, they will always tell you that they make their own calls and Murdoch doesn't tell them what to write. But they will also always tell you that people within the empire know what Murdoch thinks on any issue, and they know how to basically make sure that they commission coverage that will please their master. So his influence is incredibly strong. And there have been times in the history of the Murdoch Empire when he has been incredibly actively involved in telling editors what to do and what not to do.
But I think that's called managing up, though, isn't it, Misha? I mean, we all do it. We all know what our manager thinks, and so we therefore shape our message accordingly. That's pretty standard practice, isn't it?
That's true, but as Murdoch's acquired more and more media in a whole range of different markets around the world, one of the arguments that he's used to get around regulators saying this is a concentration of power that is problematic for democracy is to say, no, my editors are all independent. So the fact that they are actually influenced by Murdoch as the head of that empire is significant, because it's an issue for democracy when you've got one human being exerting so much influence globally and potentially able to cause so much damage.
Of course. So talk to us, why this change of direction? Why have they decided to adopt a stronger stance on climate change?
Well, it's interesting. The Murdoch sort of official spokesperson said very clearly this week that it was not to do with pressure from advertisers, which is almost certainly evidence that it is due to pressure from advertisers, or at least partly. Many of the big companies that spend money with News Corp are understanding the realities of climate change and wanting action on it. And I think it's gotten to the point now where the recalcitrance is so dimly viewed in so many quarters in the business world, but actually it's affecting their business prospects. And I think that's largely behind the change. I think there also might be some within the company who, you know, have been campaigning for a more enlightened, progressive view, and perhaps just a sense that, you know, it's time, that this sort of recalcitrance isn't going to hold for much longer.
So it's a commercial perspective then?
Well, I would say there would be a large proportion of that in the decision making. I mean, you can never know for sure, and these decisions are obviously complex and internally made, but there's certainly strong commercial pressure on them from a range of advertisers that they need to lift their game in this area.
And is this an Australian initiative or a global initiative? Because if it's Australian, I have this sort of horrible feeling that it might be aligned to the Glasgow Convention that's coming up shortly. And
oh, that's a bit cynical.
It is an Australian initiative. Right. It's the editorial board meeting was chaired by the editor of The Australian, Chris Dorr, and then there are all the other editors of the key tabloids around the country that were part of that meeting. So it is an Australian initiative, but you know, obviously you've got Joe Biden in the US making very, very strong noises about the existential threat posed by climate change. You've got Scott Morrison under increasing pressure to come to Glasgow with something concrete. You know, the US has got a very dim view of Australia's performance on climate change. And the difficulty is he's really wedged by the National Party, by Barnaby Joyce, whose elevation to the leadership owes quite a bit to his sort of generally sceptical approach to climate change policy.
Show me the plan. Show me the plan.
That's right. Show me the plan, which is his way of defending himself against... If he goes along with a plan to reduce emissions put forward by Morrison, there's a chance that could destabilise his leadership. So he needs to have some sort of political cover, and he needs to have been seen to at least have fought the good fight. Michelle Grattan wrote a really good piece about it this week, saying that behind the scenes, both Joyce and Morrison are quite pragmatic, and they know that they need to move. But the difficulty is the threat it presents from Joyce's leadership.
It's interesting that what you say, Misha, about that News Corp, perhaps this is a reaction to some of their advertisers, and as a result, News Corp are going to change their editorial policy. I remember a few years ago when I worked for Mercedes-Benz having a lunch with a number of very senior News Corp people, and I'm talking seriously senior News Corp people, who told me that that if you don't advertise, you won't get editorial. So now their advertisers are saying to them, we won't advertise unless you change your editorial policy. Bit of a juxtaposition for them. But the reality is they will lose advertisers unless their editorial position reflects community expectations. And I don't just mean those who read the News Corp papers, but other people, because they actually want more of them to read News Corp, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's interesting because you actually raise a really good point, which is in the normal course of events, if advertisers were calling the tune for editorial approach, we'd be very concerned. I think that in this instance, what the advertisers are asking for is actually a reflection of a view that's already widespread in the community and a view that is very well supported by the science. So to some extent, it's less concerning than it might otherwise be. If the advertisers were pushing for a particular vested interest of their own that wasn't in the public interest and they were calling the tune, the editorial tune, because of that, you would be arguing that that's inappropriate. But News Corp has been swimming upstream on this issue for so long, and it was inevitable that they were going to do what one of their tabloid editors, Calvin McKenzie, would call a reverse ferret. And that's basically where you take an editorial position And then at a certain point in time, when the weather changes, you basically change that position and pretend that your new position is the one that you had all along.
Just for the record, we actually reduced our advertising in News Corp papers as a result of that discussion.
Hmm.
We said, well, we actually want independent editorial. We don't want advertorial, so we don't need to advertise. They didn't like that either.
It's a good outcome, I think.
They didn't like that either. Tass.
That's a very principled macker. Just before we move on, just a call out, if you want to react or ask us a question or give us some feedback, please shoot us an email at onair@joy.org.au or shoot us an SMS at 0427-569-949. So, Misha, back to the topic. Where do you think this is going to land? Do you think that we'll start to see much more measured editorial coverage around climate change issues? Or can we just be cynical about this?
It's a good question. Andrew Bolt's already made some comments basically saying that if, you know, News Corp tries to influence his line, he'll be leaving the company. And there are some people who have been so strident for so long and who have invested so much in this sort of climate sceptic position, it's going to be very hard for them to turn around. But I do think that overall we will see an incremental change in coverage. It won't be consistent across all the titles. You will still see some of the sort of climate denialism and scepticism pushes against carbon reduction policies through the titles. But I think it'll be the beginning of a gradual change, probably, is what we're likely to see.
Thank God for that.
You are on Saturday Magazine Joy 94.9.
Thanks, Macca. Misha, each time I go to a chemist or a supermarket or a shop or the butcher or the baker or whatever it might be, I always check in. I do it via my QR code. And I understand that police are now looking to actually use some of that data. Tell us what your investigations have uncovered there.
Well, they're actually not my investigations. There was a story in the newspapers this week. But basically, what they've revealed is that police have been consistently trying to access this data for criminal investigations. And in some cases, they've been successful. They've accessed data twice in Western Australia, for example. They've tried to use the data three times in Victoria. And it's a really significant ethical issue because basically the Australian community has been asked in a time of emergency to provide this information to serve the interests of public health. And as part of doing that, we've made an incredible compromise. We're giving the government data that we would not normally give them that allows them incredible information about our whereabouts and our activities, tracking what we're doing. And in my view, it's an extraordinary breach of faith that it would be that this data should be even vulnerable to requests from the police.
Mm-hmm.
In New South Wales, they've actually already banned the use of the QR code for any police investigations. But I think it's extraordinary that it's not banned across the country and that it's not absolutely fundamentally clear that this could never happen and should never happen.
Yes, I feel a bit uncomfortable about that. I have to confess that if I know that my data is going to be misused, I will probably think twice about checking in on every occasion. And I'm actually a very law-abiding citizen, to be quite honest with you. So I see this as being an important public health tool. But if it's going to be used to do other things with, I feel very uncomfortable about that. Misha, let's...
Yeah, I mean, you could sort of take some sucker from the fact that the requests in Victoria have not been successful. There's been three requests. But I think what we need now really is that the Victoria Police need to come out and say, as a matter of policy, or the government, that no further requests will be made and that this will not be allowed. Just basically on, you know, to sort of increase public faith in the system, that we've gone to such lengths to support in the interest of the broader community, I think it's important that we know that our data be protected.
Yes, absolutely. Let's change our topics a little bit. I understand that you've been looking at, or one of your journalists has been writing about hospital capacity and some of the modelling around in relation to COVID. Tell us about that. Misha?
Yeah, this actually wasn't me. It's Rick Morton of the Saturday Paper, who's a terrific journalist.
Oh, I see.
And he's been doing a lot on sort of the public health issues around COVID. And basically his reporting now is saying that it looks like the sort of crisis in the hospital system is going to last at least 6 months. And the hospital system, particularly in New South Wales, but also in Victoria, is under incredible stress in terms of the impact of COVID. There's been impacts on staffing numbers. There's been impacts on capacity. And I just think it's a really interesting question, because there should have been, one would have hoped, a long period to be able to plan for this. And it still seems like we're in a situation where we could potentially be caught short over a long period of time. I mean, Tess, you might know more about this, but it just seems like there's going to be quite a prolonged period of stress for the hospital system.
I see this as being month 18 into a five-year cycle, so we've got a long way to go. It doesn't mean that we will be in lockdown for the next 5 years, but COVID will be around for a long time to come. Look, you know, my observation is that health providers are working very hard and doing a lot of planning, a lot of preparation. There's a lot of stockpiling of equipment, medication, PPE, all that sort of thing that's happening at the moment. And the truth is that we do have workforce shortages in this country. Most people don't realise that our rural and our outer urban health services rely on overseas clinicians.
Yes.
First-year docs from the UK, nurses from the UK, from the Philippines, from India, from China. So we rely on that workforce, and that workforce supply has now dried up. I feel somewhat assured that the Victorian government is now out there recruiting clinicians to bring back to Victoria. But yeah, it is a really stressful place. I mean, how many of us, you know, put your hand up if you've actually spent the day working with an N95 mask on, a face shield, gloves, aprons, none of us do that.
No.
I had to wear a N95 mask the other day for 90 minutes and it nearly killed me. So I hear this. I have a bit more confidence in our health system, of course. I think that our health system's doing a great job. Macca?
I agree. And, you know, I think, you know, the challenge we're going to have is how we resource our health services for the future, bearing in mind that, you know, this has got a long, long time to play out. We're seeing in the different states, you know, New South Wales is in a very different situation to us, as we are in a different situation to other states. I wanted to ask you quickly, Misha, before we go, we've still got quite a bit of time. What are your thoughts on Gladys Berejiklian deciding no longer daily press conferences?
God, that was an interesting one. I mean, I can understand, as a journalist, why everyone in the media would be annoyed, because what we want in the media is the performance, so that we can get the grabs the night of news,
course,
or get a nice quote for the next day's newspaper. You're actually wanting the Premier to provide content for you. I think that her reason for not doing the daily briefing that she stated was about trying to create a sense that there is going to be a state of sort of COVID normality, that this is something we're going to be living with now, we're going to be updated, and that can be done by public health officials. It doesn't need the Premier out every day with that sense of, you know, that you're leading the state through this absolute state of, you know, acute crisis. And I have some sympathy with that argument. I'm not quite sure if there are other political reasons, if her advisors have told her she's doing a bad job or if it's not playing well or anything else behind the scenes. But I do think that the idea of signalling to the public a sense of normality and moving away from this crisis mentality actually does make some sense.
I think it was interesting, Misha, when she made the announcement, and she said, I'm not sure, as she looked to the side, what people will think about this. And then she used the argument, yes, we need to, you know, we need to accept that we're living with COVID. But the thing that really stuck in my mind was when she said, you know, if the leader of the state government, you know, is going to spend an hour here every day, then that stops me from doing your job. Well, guess what, GLAD? That is your job. Now,
I have another perspective on this, Michael.
No, but also, sorry, and in a time where infections are going to increase further and further and further, okay, we will have a video streamed report from the health officials, and if the media want to ask questions, they can email them in.
Oh, is that what you said?
They can email them in.
Oh.
So,
I mean, I don't think she said she's not going to do any press conferences.
Oh, no, I'll do it when it, I'll do it when it's necessary. Right?
Yeah.
I'll give you a prediction.
I have another perspective on this. The press conferences
will be back.
I actually think it's incredibly short-sighted of her, to be honest. We all see this as being about accountability and, you know, keeping the leader of the state accountable for their actions, their planning of the pandemic response. However, it's also a way for the leader to bypass editorial opinion and directly speak with the public. The number of people who, in lockdown, switch on to the 11 o'clock news broadcast of the press conference and directly engage with the Premier. It's a very powerful way for the Premier to bypass media editorial and speak directly to the public. And I think Daniel Andrews did that and did that very well. And in fact, it might have been him that set the precedent for creating the daily press conference and has now created a noose for every other Premier's neck. But that aside, I think it's a way of actually communicating very directly with the public. And that's where I think perhaps it might be a bit short-sighted. That's my view.
Yeah, that could be true. Yeah. I mean, there is an argument about time allocation, though, in that if you are doing a long, you know, hour-long press conference every day, there's the preparation time for that as well. It does become a very big chunk of your activities. And I could see an argument that... you know, you might not feel that it's necessary to do every day if you don't have significant new information to add.
Call me cynical. There's not much preparation. The answers are the same. They're the same.
Well,
the best health advice, and I just want to say, and please, like, really, this is her...
No need to get personal.
No,
okay?
this is her job, right? And to say that by doing these press conferences, I'm not able to do my job, right? It's nonsense. It's about abrogation of responsibility for the job that you have. It's as simple as that, from my perspective. And if it was Dan Andrews that said the same thing, I would say the same thing about him. That's your job. Dan, that's your job.
Do you think that there'll be a point at which Dan Andrews could say, I'm not going to do daily press conferences anymore?
I think...
Not while the crisis is peaking.
Yeah.
I mean, it hasn't peaked in New South Wales or Victoria. And to say, like, I think timing was pretty poor, actually, to say at this point in time that I'm not going to do a press conference because I've got more important things to do. Well, I wouldn't have. I can't see that there's anything more important than pandemic management at the moment.
Yeah. Look, I think that's probably true. I think you both convinced me. I was trying to give her the benefit of the doubt, but I think you're right. Politically, she needs to be out.
Yes. Anyway, she's not going to listen to me, so that's all right. That's fine.
Misha, what else is hot on your agenda? What else are you doing that's, you know, perhaps outside the world of politics?
Well, actually, sorry, this one's inside the world of politics.
Okay.
The other thing I was interested in this week was the return of Matthew Guy as opposition leader in Victoria. Just because there was a really interesting piece by a human rights lawyer Nigel Newon from the African community, who was basically just saying, you know, I remember what you did last time you were opposition leader, and that was a very strong law and order campaign that was based on really whipping up racist fears about African gangs in concert with the federal government, with the Commonwealth. You know, Peter Dutton talked about people being afraid to go out to dinner, for example. And that actually led to a 50% increase in racist attacks. It led to a lot of pain for the African community in Victoria. And this sort of human rights lawyer was basically saying to Matthew Guy, a bit of a, I guess a shot across the bow, it was in the Fairfax papers, basically saying we remember.
I think they quoted Jew Misha. I think they quoted Jew Misha.
Yes, they did. Yeah, it was an article that I wrote at the time after I'd spoken to a Commonwealth minister who was talking about their sort of desire to campaign on this issue. And look, you know, the whole thing was appallingly cynical at the time. It was very disappointing. So hopefully Matthew Guy Mark 2 will have changed his tune a little bit, but that remains to be seen.
Well, you'll have to listen in at 11:14, Misha, because we're speaking to him.
Excellent. Yes. Good. Well, maybe you could ask him a question about that.
We've got the New Age guy.
He did say, I think there was a report in the papers today that he's going to increase the number of women in...
He did say that.
In senior ranks in the Liberal Party, so that'll be interesting to see.
And not via quotas. He'll do it through other means.
He also said, which I thought was interesting, and we'll close on this. Matthew said, when members do retire, I will be telling the party, not asking the party to diversify. Let's see how that goes.
Misha, thank you for your time as always. Great chatting with you on air. And,
that's right, thank you.
And keep up the great work.
We've got a lot of journalists on this one. We've got Adele Ferguson next, Misha.
Oh, terrific.
Yes. You must get us Michelle Grattan. We want to have a chat to Michelle Grattan on here.
I'd love to speak with
Tass
Michelle.
Tass wants to talk to Michelle. I do too. So let's make it happen.
I will ask her for you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Saturday Magazine on Australia's first and only gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.